This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Donald Trump's absolute disregard for scientific reality, whether it's the coronavirus or climate change, has been a signature of his presidency. His open contempt for putting on a mask was a threat from the first to the countless Americans who choose to emulate him. It endangered, in the end, the president's own life and the lives of everyone around him. Last week, just as Trump was leaving Walter Reed Hospital after a stay of 3 days, Dr. Anthony Fauci sat down for a conversation with The New Yorker's Michael Spector. Fauci is the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is a branch of the NIH, and he's really the most public voice in this country for medical reason. Michael is a longtime staff writer at The New Yorker, covering medicine and the sciences. They spoke on Monday.
As we are speaking, the President of the United States is scheduled to leave the hospital any minute, and he's going to go back to the White House. And I'm not going to ask you to comment on his strange regimen of drugs or how he's feeling. I know you're not his personal physician, and that's not your thing. But I do want to talk about public health, because this afternoon he tweeted, COVID, no big thing. Don't be afraid of it. And, you know, 210,000 Americans have died and 6-7 million have been infected. Is it fair to say no big thing, don't be afraid of it?
Yeah, well, you know, Michael, that's been one of the things that have been sort of a bone of contention in communication of the seriousness of this. I mean, obviously, it's a very unusual pathogen that can have virtually no effect in the sense of 40%, 45% of people can be without symptoms. And then for those who have symptoms, the overwhelming majority of them are mild. But there are a group of individuals who fall into a certain subset or category, namely the elderly and those with underlying conditions at any age, who can have a severe outcome. So when you look at the now 210,000 people in the United States of America who've died, and you talk about the 7 million who've been infected, and the 1 million who've died globally, I think anybody who's looking at this realistically has to say that this is a very serious disease that we need to reckon with.
The White House will now not do any contact tracing from the September 26 Rose Garden event to celebrate the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Are you comfortable commenting on that?
You know the answer to that, no. I'm not. I don't want to get into what the White House is or is not doing. That becomes non-productive and doesn't really help the messages that I'm trying to get across. Sorry, Michael.
Well, let me just, it was a try. But let me ask you in a slightly more general way. How can we stamp this thing out if we don't contact trace? How can we know who's infected and who isn't infected if we don't follow the people who are infected and see who they were in contact with? Is there a way other than contact tracing?
You know, we do need contact. Contact tracing is important. I mean, it's one of the many tools that we have to try and contain an outbreak. It is likely, we haven't proven it yet,
but likely that an asymptomatic person during that gathering at the White House began the chain of transmission that obviously occurred within that group. I must tell you, Michael, that in this situation that we're in, where infection comes to a great extent from people without symptoms, it becomes very difficult and problematic to do adequate contact tracing, even if you wanted to do adequate contact tracing. The community spread among people who are without symptoms make that very, very difficult.
We have a real problem in this country with people believing in vaccines. They are hesitant. I'm not even talking about the hardcore anti-vaccine activists, just people who are afraid. And what has gone on with the discussion of the vaccine until now has not made people more confident. They already say, to the tune of about 40%, that they won't take the vaccine. How do we get people back to the point where they think the things that will save their lives will actually save their lives?
You know, Michael, there's not going to be an easy answer to that. First of all, we need to be completely transparent and consistent in what we do. This is true for everyone out there. It becomes even more imperative to do that with minority communities because traditionally and historically, minority communities have not been served well by the government and by society in general. And they don't trust authority for a number of reasons, many of which are really justified. So you've got to overcome that barrier. And that's what we try to do. We try to get community people who they trust to go into the community and try to get them to understand the importance for their own health, but also for the health of the community. It would be tragic if we do get a safe and effective vaccine, but they don't benefit from it because A, they refuse to get involved in the clinical trials, or B, once the clinical trials are over, they don't believe that the vaccine is safe and effective for them and they don't take it. When in fact, they stand to benefit the most from a safe and effective vaccine.
When you describe this, it makes me wonder how short of a very effective vaccine, which even if we're lucky, it's not going to happen soon and it's not going to be distributed immediately, we are going to get out of this. It looks like we have a long way to go in this pandemic before we go to the movies. Are we ever going to go to the movies again?
Yes, we are, Michael, and I'll even buy you a ticket. We'll go together to alleviate your anxiety. You know, we will.
Okay.
So I get asked this question all the time. When are we going to get back to something that closely resembles or is in fact normal as we knew it? It is likely that we will know that we have a safe and effective vaccine by, let's say, November or December of this year. That I have cautious optimism that we will have a vaccine. We're already making doses, a lot of doses, tens and hundreds of millions of doses, to be ready. First, at least in graded numbers at the end of the year in November, December, and then as we get into January, February, March, April, by the time we get to April, we likely will have doses to be able to vaccinate anybody who needs to be vaccinated. But you need to have a highly effective vaccine, and you need to get a substantial proportion of the population vaccinated. So let's say we get a 70% effective vaccine, which I hope we will get, but only 60% of the people get vaccinated. There are going to be a lot of vulnerable people out there, which means that the vaccine will greatly help us to pull back a bit on the restrictions that we have now to maintain good public health. But it's not going to eliminate things like mask wearing and avoiding crowds and things like that. So I think we can approach normality. We may have theaters where you got to make sure that you don't have full capacity, that maybe you wear a mask at the theater. That may go on for months and months. I can't predict how long, but I don't think we're going to be back to normal until the end of 2021. And that's just, you know, a prediction. And we may do better than that. I hope so, but I don't think so.
I want to switch a bit to the AIDS era. There was a guy who died this year who was very important to both of us. He called both of us murderers at different points in our life, but we ended up both being somewhat close to him. And I wanted to play just one little interaction between you and the person I'm talking about, for those who are out there, is Larry Kramer, who was a signature AIDS activist and a really remarkable person who was both difficult and thrilling at the same time. And I'd like to play an exchange. This is from the 90s when Tony and Larry were on a television talk show together.
We're not going to get the answer tomorrow. And the kinds of inroads that are made, as small as they are, science works in small building blocks of knowledge.
Oh, Tony, stop it. Yes, the answer could come tomorrow. Why do you automatically take such a negative attitude? No, you're not going to get it. Let me finish. And it doesn't. It happens in big building blocks as well as little building blocks. It's all of this rhetoric of yours and everybody else in a bureaucracy. I want to say something about Tony Fauci, because I think the world must think I hate him or something, the way I'm going on tonight. I love Tony. Actually, I think I probably have a more complicated relationship with Tony than anybody in my entire life. He is a man, an ordinary man, who is being asked to play God, and he is being punished because he cannot be God. And that is a terrible situation to be in, to be the lightning rod for all of us.
True?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I wouldn't as you know, Larry would be very theatrical and confrontative, but there was so much wisdom in his words. And to an extent, it was true, because I was put in a position that I was the face of the government and I was leading the biomedical research effort. And the biomedical research effort could not possibly have moved quickly enough to save so many of the people back then who you and I know and knew, some of whom were very close to me, who were infected and who died of AIDS before we had the life-saving drugs that we had now. And I was called upon to do this, what took years, to do it tomorrow. But these activists had certain things that they were confronting that I said to myself very clearly, it was unambiguous. I said, if I were in their shoes, I would be doing exactly what they were doing. In fact, maybe even more forcefully.
Did you honestly felt many years ago that was the end of it, right? But it's gotten pretty difficult, hasn't it? On a personal level. Why do you think that is?
I mean, the activists never threatened us in a serious way. They wanted to gain our attention. Their motivations were all pure, and we developed extraordinarily good relations with them. The threats that I would get back then of the people who are, I guess, the extremist far rights, were very upset that they felt I was expending a lot of time worrying about these gay guys, these queers, or whatever it is that they were, you know, calling them, because I was very empathetic to the gay community. And these were a minor group of people that I just blew off. And I mean, and their threats were nothing but silly things. The threats that we get now are real. I mean, threats on life, harassment of family, harassment of my wife, harassment of my children, that requires our needing security. But right now, I believe, Michael, it's a reflection of the extreme divisiveness in our society when a public health message becomes opposing political views. Everybody wants to get the country back to normal again. The enemy is not the public health mandates. The enemy is the virus. Let's get that clear. The enemy is the virus. But it seems that that's not the way things are rolling out here.
Anthony Fauci, the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He spoke with staff writer Michael Spector on the first day of the New Yorker Festival, which runs through October 11th. Michael is also the author of Fauci, a new autobiography published by Pushkin Industries. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. During the first presidential debate, and possibly the last, Chris Wallace asked Donald Trump if he would denounce white supremacist violence at protests in Kenosha and Portland.
I would say almost everything I see is from the left wing, not from the right wing.
So what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it. Do you want to call him? What do you want to call him? Give me a name.
White supremacists and
right wing. Who would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right wing.
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. But I'll tell you what. Somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right-wing problem. This is a left-wing.
He did not rise to the occasion. Rather than repudiate the Proud Boys, the president seemed to recognize them as his own. And that shouldn't have been a surprise. Trump has ignored or downplayed right-wing extremism from the start, whether it was longtime Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke, or the very fine people on both sides at Charlottesville, or Kyle Rittenhouse, the gunman in the Kenosha shooting. Our producer, Kalalia, has been looking at how this encouragement of white supremacy is playing out on the ground in Portland, where right-wing violence is rising fast. Here's Kalalia.
Max Smith is in his late 30s. He's a father of four, and he lives in Portland, Oregon.
I wasn't initially planning on going out to protest.
He's been to dozens of protests in the past, but when the protest erupted over the killing of George Floyd, he could barely function.
Causing me to wake up with headaches. It was causing me to stress. It was causing me to have depressive feelings and feelings of futility. It interrupted my ability to get things done during the day.
During the first intense week of protest in Portland, at the very beginning of June, one story finally got Mac up and moving.
Police shot their own anti-bias trainer in the groin with a rubber-coated steel ball bullet, bursting his testicle. Derek Sanderlin is 27 years old, African-American.
He was out protesting, and it turned out that he was actually a person that trains the police on a de-escalation, you know, works in a very white world. Does all the things that they ask you to do. Well, if you have questions, then you should go and help. Or if you have suggestions, you should go and help. And they still shot him. And that hit me pretty hard. And I realized that, like, you're not going to fix this system from the inside. This needs to be completely rebuilt.
The group that is gathered at North Lombard Street and North Interstate Avenue must disperse to the east immediately. The group that is gathered at North Lombard Street and North Interstate Avenue.
So Mac went out to protest. And like many protesters, Mac wants Mayor Ted Wheeler to resign. Plus, he wants the police budget cut by half.
When the protests began, I mean, I was really just out wearing jeans and a t-shirt, a face mask for, you know, COVID protection. And that was pretty much it.
It's a beautiful day to protest. The weather's definitely on our side.
Then one night, a friend of Max was hit by a gas canister, which exploded and damaged his friend's skull.
That's when I realized I needed a helmet. And then 2 days later, after getting a helmet and a face shield, I got shot in the face.
And what does it feel like to be shot in the face?
Oh, it's like getting hit with a baseball bat.
Mac was hit in the forehead by what he believed to be an indelible paintball gun, like the ones they use in the military.
And it actually gave me a lump, like a Daffy Duck lump, like, bloop, you know, it was huge.
Mac moved to Portland when he was 11. His family had come from Queens, New York. And being Black in Portland was really difficult.
You know, I moved out initially to an area that's now called Happy Valley. Back then it was just called Clackamas. And I remember kids used to ask me, like, if I washed more, if the black would come off. Or kids would say, you know, don't mind my brother. He's never seen a black person before. And so it was definitely kind of a pioneering experience for us being out here.
Even today, the state of Oregon is about 3% black and Portland a mere 6%.
It's always been a bit of a struggle being black here.
It's incredibly important to recognize that Oregon as a state and the entire Northwest was founded as a racist white utopia.
Walida Imarisha is a local historian who teaches at Portland State University. She gives a presentation titled, "Why Aren't There More Black People in Oregon?"
So in 1844, the entire Northwest through the Oregon Territory passed the first black exclusion law that said that black people were not allowed to be in the Oregon Territory. It criminalized their presence and their existence.
One of the black exclusion laws was known as the Peter Burnett Lash Law, named after a former slave owner from Missouri. The law stated
that black people would be publicly whipped up to 39 lashes every 6 months until they left the territory.
39 lashes every 6 months. What's really important to know is that Oregon was the only state admitted to the Union with the racial exclusionary clause in its constitution.
The idea was that white people could come to the Northwest and build the sort of white society they had dreamed of away from people of color.
The exclusion laws were repealed in 1926, but Oregon's constitution still had language that racially classified citizens, such as free Negroes, mulattoes, and whites. This was up until 2002.
For anyone who was here in 2002 in Oregon, we remember it was a fight to get that language removed. There was immense pushback. It went to the ballot measure, and 30% of Oregonians voted to leave the black exclusion language in our constitution.
Max Smith was in his 20s when the ballot was voted. He remembers thinking,
why was this even here? You know, and why would it have stayed for so long? But when you look at a lot of things in Oregon history, that's just the way that things were.
Now, all this may seem surprising to you because of the reputation of Portland. It's being a liberal lefty fantasy land, Portlandia and all that. And in some ways, it is that too. I reached out to my friend Dwyan.
I had no idea what Oregon was about. I don't even think I knew Portland was in Oregon.
So, yeah, why in the world are you a black man? You've traveled all over the world. Please refresh my memory. Like, why are you there?
Kalalea, man, it's really beautiful here in Portland. A lot of water, a lot of rain, and trees. It is known for its trees, and I love trees. You know, just having so many options in terms of food.
Did I mention Dwyan's a vegan?
It was like I landed in a place that I was really looking for, you know?
Yeah.
Whether you are gay, whether you are black, whether you are all the other minorities, you're welcome here. And everybody's into recycling. I've seen white mothers and daughters on the street corner by themselves. This is not in a big protest rally. Both are wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts and waving a Black Lives Matter flag. I was like, is this genuine or is this a hoax? I mean, what a way to waste your time in a predominantly white you know, I don't know. I'm still trying to wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
As Portland became the socially liberal, like more cosmopolitan city, the same did not happen in the suburbs. The city is a blue island in a pretty red state, and that's caused tensions to rise, particularly with the police. In the first 2 weeks of June, Mac was working during the day and protesting well into the night. At the same time, Portland City Council was gearing up to vote on its new budget, which included millions of dollars of cuts to the police budget.
Yeah, how were you feeling during the week of the city council vote?
There was definitely a lot of anxiety.
Calling the 2 p.m. city council meeting to order. Today we will begin taking the final series of steps.
Hundreds of residents made public comments.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
The city of Portland has done everything possible throughout its history to violently exclude, remove, and destroy Black people.
Split the $246 million budget in half.
The city should set measurable multi-year goals.
Require the footage to be collected properly. We can essentially stop the police from alleging malice. And
I've seen far more violence from the Portland police in the last 2 weeks than I have in 6 months in a combat zone.
On June 17th, the city council voted. The outcome, they cut the budget by $15 million.
It's not what we asked for, but the winds have changed.
This will eliminate more than 80 positions.
So we got something.
If you watch videos of the protest, you can see some of the officers shoving protesters like really hard or spraying them with tear gas, even some at close range. It's really tough to watch.
The police became more and more aggressive in their response.
Joanne Hardesty is a commissioner on Portland City Council. One of her priorities is advocating for police reform.
And honestly, I think the reason the police became more aggressive was because people were demanding we cut the police budget. And so I think their response was less about whether they felt under attack and more about their anger that people weren't just saying the police are the best thing that ever happened to our community.
What that's done now is that's exposed that the police are just fighting us over their money. Most of our police don't live in Portland. So most of this money is not even coming back into our communities, it's going into their other communities.
By the end of July, protests were actually winding down until President Trump decided to send federal agents to Portland. He was enraged by protesters fighting police and vandalizing government buildings. The protest intensified. Moms, dads, vets, yogis, teachers, students, healthcare workers all joined Portland's grassroots activists in support of Black Lives Matter.
Every day was different. Sometimes there was tear gas being shot over and behind you to trap you in, and then a tear gas shot in front of you, so you had to kind of, you know, find a way through the smokes. Some days they're just coming through the smoke and beating you up. It's literally just, it's an adrenaline pump. There's no way to calm down and relax.
Most of the federal agents left by early August. And then, a couple of weeks later, just as the protests began to die down again, white nationalists and far-right groups from all over the Pacific Northwest descend on Portland. And some of them, like the police, were also armed.
We call them the weekend shift. They come like every weekend and try and just, you know, ride through town. They do like car rallies. And it's messed up because if we don't show up to counter-protest them, they'll just like attack a homeless people and like a trans kids in the street. A friend of mine was like, you know, he was worried about me. And so he got me a Kevlar vest. Actually, I have two bulletproof vests. It's just like, we're just tanking up.
During the last weekend in August, dozens of cars and trucks full of white nationalists and Trump supporters drove into Portland for a pro-Trump rally. Mac was there.
Someone fired shots into the crowd. I had my vest, I wasn't aimed at or shot at, but, you know, it made me feel like I'd made the right choice.
It's legal in Portland to openly carry a weapon if the weapon is not loaded. But I'm not sure that anyone is checking for bullets. Mac and other protesters have mentioned that when the white nationalists show up, the police often disappear or retreat from any conflict, that they seem to be cooperating. Now, the police bureau denies that there's been any cooperation with the right-wing protesters or any favoritism shown to them. But Commissioner Hardesty has also heard from community members that this is happening.
Most recently, white nationalists showed up in force, and the police were nowhere to be seen. And the moment they left, the police came out and declared a riot and an unlawful gathering and started tear gassing people once again.
That same weekend, there was a fatal shooting. And using the most basic identifiers, a person on the left, a self-identifying anti-fascist, was suspected of killing a right-wing counter-protester. This is probably the first killing ever committed by someone in Antifa, whereas more than 300 people have died in right-wing attacks in the last 25 years.
So why is it that the city of Portland doesn't do something to prevent the white nationalists from entering the city limits, like, you know, shutting down bridges or blocking roads?
I think that there's a fear about saying that one type of protester is okay as compared to another type of protester.
That's Joanne Hardesty, a city commissioner in Portland. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Our producer, Kalalia, has been reporting on the anti-racism protests in the city and Oregon's history of white supremacist violence.
So, there may be other reasons why the police seem to be more sympathetic to the white nationalist. I spoke to two experts.
My name is Eric Ward, and I am executive director of Western State Center.
Ward is an expert on white nationalism in the Pacific Northwest.
White nationalists have been targeting law enforcement. Why do we know this? Because the Department of Justice itself released a memo that it sent to law enforcement agencies around the country, warning them that white nationalists indeed had infiltrated law enforcement and were attempting to use law enforcement to further divide Americans in order to create their pseudo-race war.
And I heard the same from Mike German. In the early 1990s, German was in the FBI, and he went undercover as a neo-Nazi.
One of the warnings I was given by my superiors at the FBI was that I would have to be very careful in protecting my identity because it was known that there were people in law enforcement who had sympathies for these white supremacist groups.
When it comes to Portland, it's hard to know how many far-right sympathizers are on the police force. But there have been connections between officers and Patriot Prayer, a far-right group based in Washington State. They're not necessarily white supremacist, but they do engage protesters in violent confrontations. During one protest, an officer texted the group's leader tactical information about protesters. And 2 years ago, at a different protest, police found Patriot Prayer members on a rooftop with loaded guns. The police seized the guns, but let the members go without reporting anything.
We're talking about a very small number of officers within law enforcement. But what we have seen is that often law enforcement agencies know about this involvement, sometimes for years, but don't take any action. And that's really the problem, is that it's allowed to persist.
There's a particular history to this in the Northwest. Eric Ward tells me that in the 1980s, white supremacist groups were encouraged to relocate to the Pacific Northwest to form a supposedly Aryan ethnostate. This neo-Nazi idea was called the Northwest Imperative. The desire for a white utopia that was formed in the Oregon Territory never went away. It's essentially being rebranded.
Here in the Pacific Northwest, we often refer to it as the Invisible War. It no longer sought to take us back to the days of Gone with the Wind, if I could be so crass, that it really sought the overthrow of the U.S. government.
Ward's talking about the 80s, but anti-government extremists are still very active. Their belief is that the government is scheming to take away the rights of U.S. citizens, and it must be resisted.
It's boogaloo time.
If we all stood together just one day, we could take this country back.
Often sporting Hawaiian shirts and military-style weapons, the Boogaloo movement is a strange mix of far right and left, working to instigate a revolution against what they see as a corrupt and dangerous government.
Not all far-right groups are looking to overthrow the government or gunning for a race war. Some simply believe in a kind of might-makes-right mentality, where white men stay fully in control.
White nationalists have targeted Portland because they see it as a progressive bastion, right, in their white nationalist homeland. They are trying to provoke a response where they feel they are then legally able to retaliate. The goal is to create violence.
Mike German, the former FBI agent, says that the government hasn't made much of an effort to combat white supremacist violence, or even to understand the problem.
Right now, only about 12.5% of law enforcement agencies report that hate crimes occur within their jurisdictions. You know, even today, the FBI can't tell you how many people white supremacists killed last year. They can tell you how many bank robberies happened. They can tell you where they happened, how much money was lost, whether a gun was used or not used, because they collect that data. But they don't collect data on white supremacist violence.
And even when there is data, some in government want to keep it from the public.
Allegations from a whistleblower at the Department of Homeland Security who says he was demoted for refusing to change intelligence reports. Now, in what he calls an abuse of power, the official claims he was ordered to suppress information that the president would not like. Now, that includes details about Russian election interference and the threat posed by white supremacists.
A month ago, Brian Murphy, a conservative Republican and the former chief of intelligence division at the Department of Homeland Security, revealed that his superiors had instructed him to downplay national security threats of white supremacy. And Murphy's not alone. He's actually the third high-ranking official to make those charges at the agency. The Department of Homeland Security denies Murphy's allegations. So while hate crimes by white nationalists are rising, there has been an effort to cover it up at the highest levels of government.
We have to finally acknowledge this is something that needs to change, and it's only going to change if we force it to. And that's why I give so much credit to the people that are out in the street demanding action, often in the face of violent police response.
Because of the wildfires, Max Smith took a short break from protesting. But at the end of September, he was back on the streets. The notion of a race war, extremists with guns and hopes to divide and kill, is absolutely terrifying. But that isn't the thing that motivates Mac.
I don't know that the race war is going to pop off in Portland, Oregon. So I think it's kind of a test. There aren't actually that many black people in Portland, right? I've been dealing with skinheads and stuff since I was a kid. Honestly, that's not the fight that I'm here for.
For Mac, the bigger issue is the white supremacy that remains when the violent extremists go home.
I'm not here to fight the alt-right. I'm not here to fight the feds. We're just here to fund the police. And so, you know, it's really important for me to cut through all of that and get right back to the point. It's not something that's just like, oh yeah, they painted a street and said BLM. You know, it's not, you know, a Nancy Pelosi wearing a kente cloth in the Capitol or something. You know, that stuff doesn't help us. You know, giving us a TV show where, you know, the black woman becomes God in the end. That's great. You know, it's a TV show, though. We need something real. We need a real change we can feel, like that we can be like, yeah, we did this. We just took a whole summer of our lives and dedicated it to a cause, and they gave us an actual change. They decided to stop acting like we were terrorists and give us what it is we're asking for.
Max Smith in Portland, Oregon. The protests are in their fifth month. Kalalia is a producer for the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's more to come, so please stay with us.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm going to turn things over now to staff writer Vincent Cunningham.
So Rada Blank started out life as a playwright in New York, and for years she struggled as a playwright. She never quite got that big production that put her on the map. Like a lot of playwrights, she taught writing in public schools and community centers. But unlike a lot of playwrights, Rada also started a sideline as a rapper. She performed in New York under the name Rodimus Prime. Somewhere in the middle of all this, Rada wrote a movie. It's called The 40-Year-Old Version. That's V-E-R-S-I-O-N, version. It's about a struggling playwright named Rada who decides to pursue a career as a rapper.
Oh, no. So what you call yourself?
Huh?
So what they call you? What they call you?
Rada. Must. Prime.
What?
Rodimus Prime.
Oh, shit, like Optimus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What happened next was like something out of a struggling playwright's fantasy. First, Lena Waithe got hold of the script and offered to actually produce it. And she wanted Rada to both direct and star in it. Then the movie got into the Sundance Film Festival, which is a big deal for anybody's first movie. Then Rada won an award for directing at that festival, making her only the second Black woman to ever win that award. You're so much better lit than I am.
When you say lit.
You are both more lit than I am in the colloquial sense, but you're also better lit in the technical sense
okay.
of
because there
location.
Is a distinction. I appreciate that.
I spoke to Rada Blank last week. I just wonder, just on a personal level, what it was for you like to move from, as you say, this sort of struggling in the theater world to then winning the Director's Award at Sundance. Just what ran through your mind in that moment? How was that?
In that moment, I was like, oh, shit, they got that wrong. But I see myself having already won some other awards. Like the fact that Black people go to see the movie and say it's Black as fuck. Like that's a huge compliment to me. When New Yorkers see the film and they say, oh, my God, you know, that's my hometown. And now I'm in it. You know, that's a huge award for me.
Rada.
Excuse me. Ladies. Rada.
How are you?
Hey. Just puckering up to the patrons as usual. How are you?
Good.
Archie tells me you're teaching.
I've been teaching for a while now.
Well, theater misses you.
Does it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it looking for me? Because I've been here.
So Rada, what was your theater work like? What were your concerns when you were writing primarily for theater, and how has that, if at all, how has that made its way into the 40-year-old version?
You know, I feel like as a storyteller, I've always kind of, even if it was comedic, it was always through the lens of social commentary and social justice. Mm-hmm. And theater was where I really kind of lived in that world.
No. It's about gentrification. And how this young couple struggles to you didn't like it.
The idea is powerful.
But?
It rang a little inauthentic.
Okay. Well, thank you for that note. I appreciate it.
There's something there.
Okay.
I just wish you hadn't shied away from darkness. I mean, if you're going to call it Harlem Ave, you got to give me Harlem Ave.
I should write in a teen mother shooting up in an alley.
No.
It's nothing to speak ill of those Black playwrights who are getting produced. I just feel like the people who show up tend to satisfy the urges of a particular sect of people. I call them the silver-haired patrons. These are people who can afford between $100 and $150 for a ticket to theater, you know? Right. And so they then dictate what shows up on stage. And so it's their version of Blackness, one that is, you know, conflict shows up as pain, you know, in a Black story, or they're dancing and they're singing, or it's a period piece. But, you know, what it definitely avoids is being an indictment of white privilege and white culture.
No, look. Sweetheart.
Yes.
There's definitely a voice under all those words.
All those words.
But the writing needs work. The good news is, I still need a writer for my Harriet Tubman musical.
You know, I think, you know, people celebrate artists when they deem the person's art either palatable or marketable or something they can monetize. But until then, we're all just considered flaky artists. You know what I mean? And we're always confronting, whether it's the gatekeeper or the audience or the silver-haired patron, there's always this kind of dance, which can sometimes feel like pandering, so that we can get in the door and support ourselves and feed ourselves. You know what I mean? So there are all of these little compromises, I think, that you make on this path as an artist. I think the story is about someone who may or may not survive the compromise she's made.
Yeah. And one thing I noticed about the movie is that you kind of set up this dichotomy, right? Theater is a place that's got all these gatekeepers around it, all these levels to make it through. There's your agent, there's the producer, there's all these things, these screens, I guess, from your sort of vision until the whatever the product is. Where this hip hop world, you like, there's this hip hop producer D that you, and the first night that you work together, it's you saying your rhymes the way that you want them to be. It's like this hip hop as a place for control.
Yeah.
Yo, it's poverty porn. You regular Blacks are just such a yawn. Yo, if I wanna get on, better write me some poverty porn. Yeah.
How was that last one? Good. Felt good. If my kids could see me now. Not my kids. I don't have kids. I mean, my students.
I'm a teacher. There were so many Native New Yorkers working on the film that had this dogged, you know, determination to tell a New York story from a different angle. You know, my DP, Eric Bronco, was one of them. He's from the Bronx. Had never shot on black and white film before. And so we both were like kind of obsessed with how Black people and people of color would show up in those shades of gray. So, you know, yeah, I'd get intimidated, but then I realized, you know, I, not to make it sound like I'm a priest who gets a calling from the higher source, but it felt like that, you know. Some days I had to be like, girl, it ain't about you. Just do your job, you know?
I love what you said about New York. And I, you know, as a native New Yorker myself, I found myself very excited. There's a All moment right. where you can sort of see the train going under where it does, where it comes up, you know, from 125th Street.
And yeah.
It seemed like you were kind of playing to me with these, like, the way New York has been seen in film, like that the black and white brings to, you know, any number of New York films that we could mention. But it just seemed like you were playing within a tradition, but then trying to also stretch it, move it
right.
forward.
Right. Like, what we're doing is we're not inventing something new. I just think it's how and who is doing it. You know, I guess because I am black and I identify as a woman, you know, that is considered groundbreaking. But really, I'm just trying to create something that retrofit something into the canon of classic New York films, you know, a story that should have been told 30, 40 years ago. But so it feels both fresh and nostalgic, if that makes any sense. Like another compliment I feel I've gotten from audiences is when people think the film takes place in the 90s. It doesn't. It takes place now. We couldn't get a up-to-date bus, you know, city bus. And so, but it lends itself, you know, as the film opens, you hear Electric Relaxation by Tribe, and that was one of many music videos in my digital lookbook. That's all I was trying to do. It's like we're so used to seeing hip-hop like kind of oversaturated, over-sexualized, and I think black and white forces a certain, you know, level of cool, you know, and vulnerability also for the culture.
And just with you, what's your relationship to the theater now? Do you think that there is more opportunity for black artists to have control in a way that maybe isn't the case? Or what do you think?
You know what? I couldn't answer that now. I probably have to answer that in 2 or 3 years from now, because I think, you know, there's this movement of theater artists. They call themselves We See You. And they are calling out what they call WAT, White American Theater, around all of the disparity in terms of who gets to green light projects. I think an immediate response to that was numerous theaters have employed black women as, you know, artistic directors, people at the gate, so to speak. I feel there's a shift, but I feel like we won't know for a while.
Are you kind of off on this movie trajectory, or do you see yourself going back? And
I will always be a playwright, always. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's where I really got to cut my teeth and learn story and earn endings and, you know, take my obsessive deep dives into characters and why they do what they do. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how theater, yeah, I think theater is either going to love me or hate me because, you know, but that's not very different from how my career was before. They wasn't fucking with me then because I don't think I would be the playwright they wanted me to be. You know, I don't know. It'll be bittersweet to finally have my plays, which in TV, they've become writing samples, to have my plays actually be plays again, you know?
Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
It.
This was awesome.
Rada Blank is the writer, director, and star of The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which has just premiered on Netflix. You've been listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Vincent Cunningham.
And I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us today, and see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado.
We had assistance this week from Emery Mort in Portland.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.